Detta är kassett nummer 3, det är sida nummer 1 och det är fortsättning på intervjun med Esther Albright i Moline, Illinois. Och det är idag den 24
juli 1985. Well, as far as when I was confirmed, it was in Swedish, and we had a memorized Luther's catechism, and we had a public examination one Sunday. The next Sunday, we'd have communion, our first communion. And nowadays, I think maybe they try to teach qualities of good living. I don't know. They certainly don't, as far as I can understand, teach the fundamentals. And but maybe they'll. I haven't been in the to witness the confirmation classes, but I think it's a general discussion of right and wrong and trying to be responsible church members. I don't know how much they really stick to teaching the creed. I question that.
Some pastors use the. They give them a cassette to listen, you know, whatever they feel like.
Yes, that's right.
How could that be a good learning tool? Because, you know, kids, they like to listen to TV instead and
that's right.
Take it the easy way.
That's right. No, we'd have to, in fact, from the time we were in class one, the kindergarten on up through Sunday school, we'd have certain parts of the catechism we'd have to learn, and then the next part, and the next part, and then finally when we were ready for confirmation, it would be a grand review of what we had been going over, and it would every time I know that we'd meet, the minister would have a certain section that he'd quiz us on that we'd have to remember, recall everything we had learned and rattle it off, and then borrow it out of debt, and then we'd have to rattle that off. And I don't know that we learned. Maybe an awful lot, because many times I don't think we knew what the words meant. Oh, I think that's true with all of them. In fact, one good Catholic told me herself, she says there's certain words there that she didn't know what they meant until she, about 20 years later. So I think that's been true in other churches too.
So they are still perfecting it, the religion, in other words. They have been trying to improve and improve.
Yes.
Do you think it has gone like Esbjørn, Hasselquist, Ellen Carlson, Norelius, even your father? What would they say today if they go to a service, you think, or sit in a meeting, for instance?
I don't think they'd like it.
You don't think so?
No, I don't. Because they were brought up that way. And I don't think they would feel that it was thorough enough. Maybe what they would see of today they would approve of, but I think they would feel that the basic need had been left out. That's my guess.
So,
they used to have Hus for Hood or two.
Yes.
And I know my grandfather had that. He'd go around to the very, and then he'd remind them, you know, and then he'd line up the family and then go through the...
Don't you think they scared people a little bit, though?
Yes! Aunt Lydia told me that the women used to cry, and sometimes they had forgotten the lines, and the minister would come along with body debt, and the mother of the household would have to come along with saying it, and she had forgotten it, you know, and she'd weep. And
we don't have that today, but we have the driver license to take.
Yeah, we had the driver.
Well, I suppose people are different. Some say they didn't mind the Hus for Hör. In other words, they thought it was fun. People come together and they had coffee and cookies after and cake and everything. But some were really mentally disturbed.
Well, Aunt Lydia told me that many of the older women especially would cry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Aunt Lydia told me that.
There was too much respect then for religion, in other words, without the feeling secure.
Well, if they couldn't rattle off everything, why... Then it was bad. It would just, I think anybody, when he comes to a final examination of anything, experiences a certain amount of tension.
Yes.
And they would experience that tension. when they would be called to come
the,
back and
then the
explain.
A bad one to meet. But they had,
well, they didn't have news for her all the time.
No, I suppose they didn't.
No.
But the pastor was a respected person in the community.
Very highly. Yes, no. He was.
How about the pastor's wife?
Well, I know my grandmother was considered quite a help. When anybody needed any kind of help, she usually, say in sewing, they buy a bolt of material, and she'd cut the material for the dress goods. And also, she was supposed to have general idea as to household remedies for sickness. She was supposed to be able to help.
Who helped with that? What did she learn this? Did she read a lot of papers?
I don't know where she learned
practical?
It. Chances are, well, maybe she knew more than the rest of them, I don't know. But perhaps she read about it. But it may be just general cleanliness, but and some of these household remedies, you know, they were worthless. But anyway, that's what the saying was, to use this and to use that in case of such and such.
So your home now, you had access to a lot of different publications because through the college, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
Your father brought home.
Yes.
And what did they read now? Did you read the Swedish American Tribune, for instance?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then Kvinnan och Hemmet?
Yes. In fact, practically everything put out by Augustana Synod was in Swedish, except, of course, the English version for the youth, the companion. And Abrahamson would rule, of course, with
yes.
the
no,
Swedish.
I didn't know his name.
Abrahamson.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Ryden later on came in then, of course, with the English. But it was essentially Swedish and everything. And I know whenever we had the ministers in general who would meet in our house between meetings, why they preferred to use Swedish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nowadays there are changes almost every quarter. You know, in publications they shift around and they have new ideas and brain sessions, they call it. But when you were growing up then, publications from the hand of Abrahamson and Ernest Ryden or Rydén, did they go in the same rut all the time, or did they change abruptly sometime?
No, I think whatever change was made by the man that entered the office, that succeeded. Now, for instance, Lindahl, S.P.A. Lindahl, had that Augustana. And then maybe if there would be a change when Abrahamson came in, maybe fundamentally he'd have some ideas, so the change would be made by the person, and that would be consistent while he was there. It wasn't any upheaval.
So there was no personal input then of those editors, you think?
I don't think so.
Because he had to have the approval from the synod, and they were stern.
Oh yeah, I think he watched that feeling in the synod all right, because he could have been out of a job if he tried to get a little too liberal.
So the layman's input into those publications was very was minimal.
I think so.
The pastors.
That's right. I'm sure it was. In fact, Hasselquist always saw too that when ever anybody was, when the synod was going to meet, why he'd exhort the minister to see too that the lay delegates were of the proper mind, and agreeing with Hasselquist, of course.
So they stay on a long time then, Hasselquist and Carlson's. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Abrahamson was there for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So those people were happy people then when they passed away, in other words, of what they had done. Not as much Asbjorn, but like Hasselquist and Carlson. They had done a good day's work.
Mm-hmm.
And they could see the fruit of it. And
but
they wouldn't agree today, you think, what they see today. What have happened now? Your father didn't go through the joining the Germans and the Danish and the Finnish synods, 1962, to form the Lutheran Church.
They talked about many mergers.
Even in your father's lifetime?
Yes. We were having conversations or what dialogues with the Presbyterians. I remember my father talking about it, and they felt that there was a lot of agreement between the Presbyterians and the Lutherans, and so that's about as far as they came, except the element, I think, of communion. We had dialogues with the Episcopalians and found a general much agreement. And I know my father saying that, and I think about it every time I'm in church on Sunday, when they would say the Holy Catholic Church, and the Augustana people didn't like that word Catholic because they felt it would be maybe giving problems to other people, and the Episcopalians declared that they had found no such problem. And I remember Papa talking about that. Only there was a discussion of mergers. But I remember the discussions that I heard with the Presbyterians and with the Episcopalians.
Not with the Covenant Church, though, or before you signed it up?
Not to my knowledge. And I know when I talked about it with my brother, who was then a minister, I said, they're talking about mergers. And he says, I think it'd be a good idea for the Lutherans to merge first, before we merge with any other. He says, we Lutherans ought to get together. Well, that's been happening now. Except, of course, the Missouri Lutheran Church, they're just holding their nose up high against us.
And they are too orthodox in their thinking. Or
I don't know. I don't know what it is. And I have some good friends who are Missouri Lutherans, but they all seem to think that we're way beneath them.
But wouldn't you say that the Covenants, though, will be very close? We are Swedish here, most of them, and they never think about going together.
Because we really were together in the first place. Well, maybe they will someday.
But according to your knowledge, you never heard that.
I never heard it.
They never mentioned it.
I can't say that it didn't happen, but I'd say that I didn't hear it. Yes.
No, I never heard it either.
No.
It sounds like it's impossible to even, think about it. It's out of the question.
Well.
So how was this? They took a long time, and that was during Dr. Bergendorf's reign, of course, when he was the president of the college. Mm-hmm. They were still with the theological seminary then. Mm-hmm. And there was pro and cons for it, and he was one that was against the merger, wasn't it?
He went in both directions. I think he
tried to be diplomatic.
He was in favor of their separating at one time when he was still in the seminary. And I know my father felt that definitely the seminary should be part, because it was the idea of having a graduate school. And he wanted to separate. And my father afterward said, "Hur kunde Konrad tala så?" And he was very much disappointed. And then after a while, he seemed to think it was all right. So I don't know what. I think he went back and forth. I don't know.
Some say that the pastors were this driving force because they could get better pensions and so forth.
Well.
And the people were left.
Well, as far as their arguments were concerned, I don't know. My father definitely felt when he got the seminary building erected, which is now Founders Hall, that he had at least stopped this movement. But there was still, I know, Reverend Peter Peterson, he was always talking about separating, and my father could not see it. It was definitely against my father's idea. To him, it was the graduate school, of which he hoped to have many more in time.
Yes, and it was nationally embracing the whole nation.
Yeah.
Because they had 1,248 pastors at one time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Every state was represented.
That's right.
More or less.
That's right. There was one question that I wasn't sure that you were clear on last time. I'm sure maybe you are, but I wasn't sure about it. We speak about Augustana College and Theological Seminary, which was the child of the Augustana Synod. Now, all the other schools that appeared were definitely the children of the conferences. And the Synod had nothing to say about these conferences and their schools. While the Synod did have something to say about Augustana College because it owned it. And the situation was bad for Augustana because when all these conferences, especially those that had schools of their own, would come to the synodical meeting, they'd vote down anything that came up for Augustana because they said, we got our own school to take care of. Well, so Augustana became a stepchild in a way. And these conference schools were freed to do according to the directions of that conference. And for example, maybe I made it clear last time that the Reverend L.A. Johnston became president of the Synod. He told my father, there'll be no dramatics at Augustana. He was against the theater in every sense of the word, and I had been looking forward to the fact that I would, as soon as I got to be a freshman, I was going to take part in those dramatic clubs. That was ruled out. And so I didn't get any of that experience that I had been looking forward to all the time. And while in the conference school, they could, if they chose, have plays and things like that.
So Dr. Johnson had no jurisdiction over those then to tell them?
No, because they were...
That's interesting.
Yeah, they were children of the conference. And so he couldn't directly boss them, but he felt he could boss Augustana. And well, my father tried to be diplomatic because he was very much in favor of dramatics. And in fact, in his early days, he did all he could. We had Tegnér and we had Shakespeare and and quite a lot. And nowadays, they even have some of these plays on Sunday. While, so I've held that against L.A. Johnston every...
So he had power enough then to tell the rest of the board to with him?
Nothing doing with any plays. In fact, when he was pastor in Rockford, they bring it out in their books about how the women of the church, they were having some kind of a program and they were having a kind of a little playlet. When he found out they were having a playlet, he came down there, there wouldn't be anything like that. But two of his sons were interested in dramatics and went out to California and became quite active in dramatics and the movie field. I know! But I remember Johnston, and I still hold it against him because I was so deeply disappointed.
So they can have a devastating ending. So they continued all the way as long as he was the president?
Huh? Yeah, and as soon as he was out, I...
You made sure he came in again.
Well, I was gone from the college at that time, and I thought it was very narrow. And in the story of Rockford First Lutheran Church, why they bring that up about his peculiarities and have this, the story of his being so against theater. That was a sin.
But here's one thing I want to ask you now.
Bilder from Jubelfesten.
By Aina, Anna Olsson. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. Mit Federski, sir.
That's Olav Olsson's daughter.
Oh, Mia?
Yeah. Well, she called her Aina sometimes, and sometimes she called her Mia, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. She writes, you know, that's like a comic
I know.
Sense. Well, how could they take that, Augustine of the Stone, pastors and presidents of the synod and everything?
Well,
she says in here that the bishop came with the gold. Well, she says about the director for Uppsala came, for the University of Uppsala.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that han var så larder att han kan inte lära sig något mer. That was the end of it.
Yeah.
But then she said, talks about that the bishop gave out stars. And her dreamt, you know, the same night, you know, he was giving him a star too.
Yeah.
And then some pastors say they can't read it in the prophecy, you know, by the Jesus followers. They never got a star for doing anything. So they wonder, why did the Swedish pastor get something? But you never read this book?
No, I have never read it.
And you never heard your father discuss it either? I mean, her writing?
The no.
What she wrote about? Or
we usually laughed about it, and many of her writings that I...
You know her personally?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And she had a tender humor, and maybe would poke fun a little bit at the misconceptions of the translation, and I think that's what they enjoyed, and maybe would tolerate a lot that she would say that maybe they wouldn't agree with.
I'm surprised she couldn't get printed as Augustana Book Concern. It was printed as Augustana Book Concern.
Well, she worked at the Book Concern.
Well, she did?
Yeah, she had a regular office there and would go there every day.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
And she was never married?
No. None of them were married.
No, two girls?
Three.
3 years.
Anna, Maria, and Lydia.
Oh, I see. Oh, there was the Lydia you mentioned before, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see. Oh.
Yeah. But I would read especially what would appear in Augustana.
Well, she wrote also in Augustana?
Mm-hmm.
Regular English,
yeah. Well, it... No, no, no. This was Swedish. This was Swedish, and it would be... maybe afterwards it would be printed in the book. No, she had an office up there and was there regularly.
She is very humoristic though, because she calls one of the things here Consilium Squalerasticum. It's the world's biggest club, 500 million members. So she describes them, and the delegates come in, and Pa takes them in, and Mother has to give them extra spare bedroom, and they have visitors with them they didn't expect, and things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of truth in it, though.
Oh, yes, sure.
But her father died in 1900, or 1900.
It must have been 1900.
Yes.
Or 1899. It was at the turn of the century.
Did her mother live on then after?
No, the mother, I think, died before. And the father was left with the three girls when they were more or less in their teens.
So they grew up then at Augustana?
Yeah.
When
mm-hmm.
he was the president there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she talks about the delegates and...
See, her father had one time had been at in Kansas, Lindsberg, Kansas. And then later on, see, my mother was teaching school down there in the elementary department, and then she quit to go home to make plans for marrying my father, and then Mia followed her, and they kept Mia only 1 year. Apparently they weren't satisfied with her work.
Maybe she was restless.
I don't know.
So she worked at the Book Concern?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Did she go through Augustana, or was she older than when she
You came? Know, that's one thing I question that any of them got an A.B.
Oh, I see.
But I don't know. Mm-hmm. I question. Lydia had a job with a company down in Moline for years and years and years and years, and then she quit that and came in to work at the Denkman Memorial Library when it was first. She was at the desk, and I don't know that she was prepared as a librarian, but my father said there was an awful lot of kick because apparently she didn't know how to handle things, and so finally he says they simply had to let her go. But
was they under Pastor Grenier, or what was his name?
No, this was under Skarstedt.
Well, he was the...
Mm-hmm. When we moved to the Denk Memorial Library, Skarstedt had charge.
Well, he was in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how was he as a regular person,
Skarstedt? He was a very good, thorough, and a brilliant man. Mm-hmm. And he took care of the moving of the library from the building, from the rooms in Old Main, into he had a tremendous job there, and he was the chief one in charge. Grenier was still hung on in the Denkman Memorial, but I don't know that they let him do anything much except sit at the desk now and then. I know he used to be at the desk. He and Lydia, I guess both of those, they didn't quite dare to fire. And they kept him on and kept him on. And finally they let him go. And then they had to fire Lydia because, well, she didn't know anything about library. And I guess she'd have her own pet ideas, and this was it.
She didn't have the Dewey system.
No, neither did he, neither did Grenier. Not the slightest.
How could people find, well, I suppose they knew each book then by the cover, so to speak. I mean, when students wanted something, they were probably more adverse than the librarian at that time, so they could find what they wanted.
Well, of course, when they just had a room or a series of rooms there at the in the Old Main, the library wasn't very big. They could remember where a book was, not
so
necessarily.
Reach out and then,
mm-hmm.
not several floors like it is now. How about Margaret Skarstedt's father? Did you meet him?
I don't remember meeting him. I might have met him because many times visitors came to our house. I don't remember meeting him, but he was an odd duck.
Well, he was, sir.
Oh, yes. According to the story, he never contributed a cent to Marcus' education.
Is that right?
Yeah. And, well, maybe he didn't have much cash, but he was a peculiar man. And my father did all he could while Marcus was in college to help him or to get people who had money.
So he went through Augustana then?
Marcus. Yes, he graduated, I think it was 1910. Anyway, my father got what financial help he could through friends who were inclined to give to help Marcus. And then, of course, Marcus worked hard too. Marcus was a brilliant and a hard-working student. And so my father says, you take up library work and you will have a job here. And as I say, his father, now I remember, this is sort of telling tales too, when Mrs. Constant Esbern, that's the son of LP, he was had a ministry out in California, and he liked to go out on camping trips, and Aunt Sophie, that was his wife, would do what she could to pack things and to cook the meals when they were out in the wilds. And then Marcus Skarstedt's father, when he got out in the wilds, he used to enjoy being split naked. And Mrs. Edgburn didn't like that. But she said, there he would be. He enjoyed being naked.
Yeah, I guess even when other people were in the company.
Well, of course, as far as I know, there was only Constant Esbern, his wife, whom I call Aunt Sophie, and their baby daughter at the time. They were the only three, and then he joined them. So I know Aunt Sophie said she objected to that, and she didn't. Naked men running around.
But he didn't have any kind of affiliation to any religious denomination, I suppose.
I don't think it worried him very much.
He was a free thinker.
I don't know if he was or not, because he apparently thought a lot of my uncle, Uncle Philip Andreen, that was my father's brother, and he attended church frequently when my uncle would have services. And I think he even played in some kind of a little orchestra they had on special occasions in the church. So, I mean, there was an association there. I don't know whether he was a member or not, and whether he was a freethinker or not. He seemed to like my uncle and liked his sermons.
Skarstedt, he continued on at Augustana for many years as a librarian.
For many years?
Yes.
And I know my father was quite disappointed when he decided to leave, but I suppose that's natural.
Well, he left during your father's term?
Yes, and then I know when my father was about to be retired, Skarstedt came up to the house. I guess he felt, he says everybody was feeling so bad that Andreen was leaving, and so he came up, and we had an awfully good time talking and laughing, and he says, here, he says, everybody I've been seeing have been almost crying as he's leaving, and he says, I come here and we're having a happy time, joking and laughing. And
your father, no, he retired in 1934.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then he took a parish up in Wilmar?
In Wilmar, mm-hmm. Not right away, a year or so later.
Did he feel restless then after leaving? He wanted to have something to do, more constructive, or he couldn't retire completely, I suppose?
I think he was restless, and this position was an interim pastor because they had gotten in financial conditions that were very bad, and so they asked my father to just take care of things until they got a pastor. So during that time, my father was back in the old campaign business of raising money and got the church back. It was going to be in the hands of the receivers, I think, and it was going to be taken over. And he really had to do some hard work there to get the people to come across.
So your parents moved up to Minnesota then?
Yeah, they lived there then for about 2 years.
Well, they packed up everything.
Well, not exactly. They took some things, but in their house here, they rented temporarily to Martin Johnson and his family. You know, Eleanor Johnson,
she
was the daughter, so she lived there. The folks were glad to have somebody in the house. And so the furniture and everything was there except what Mama had taken up. Mama hadn't taken very much. And then the people came in with things. I know Father jokingly said, each one bring in a chair, be sure that they don't match. And they managed to temporarily get along. But he got the church back on financial position.
And that was during the height of the Depression.
Yes. And he had a hard time, so he was back at his old job, collecting money.
How did he like that? Did he feel fulfilled of doing this?
Well, he enjoyed the work there very much. However, I remember Paul's telling me, my brother, telling me that he hadn't met the quota to hand in to the synod, because he was more interested in seeing, too, that they got the mortgages paid and whatnot, so he didn't make his payment. He says, Father sees for the first time the position when he come in and try to get the minister to raise money for Augustana. Well, this time he was raising money to keep the church from being sold.
So he got a prime sample of how it works.
Yeah, I know.
In real life.
He said he sees the other side of it now. And so he didn't make that quota that year, he was the powers that be from the synod wrote, and they wanted a certain amount of money, and Papa was using all of that money to pay off the mortgage.
He had a very small salary, and maybe nothing at all.
I really don't know. I don't know.
Because you have to make ends meet.
That's right.
More than one way.
That's right. Oh, I'm sure they saw too that he had enough to live on. I don't think that worried him any.
So he died now in
1940.
Mm-hmm. And your mother, she still lived another 10 years? Or?
She lived until 48.
Mm-hmm. And then he came down here to, he lived then down here in Rock Island and the nest.
Well, no, my father, he bought a house that the college had a mortgage on in Moline.
In Moline?
2824 16th Street. And the college let my father buy it at the cost. So my father wasn't given that house. It was, and as long as my father lived, he was putting in payments for the house. Then when he died, the board decided to cancel the payments and let my mother have the house, what was left. But my father had already been paying for years and years.
So your mother now, she reminisced a little bit in the last days of her life. You mentioned in your dissertation about your family or your mother.
Mm-hmm.
In 1948, she married a Swede and she went back a little bit in time. How did she sum up her life, so to speak?
Well, I know she said to me one time that my mother would roll in her grave if she could hear sometimes the way I talked, because she would say sometimes we Swedes have to stick together, and she says my mother would roll in her grave with such thoughts. No, I think my mother felt completely converted over into the Swedish element, and she always had great admiration for my father. She says I always felt he was a brilliant man, and she always felt that his work was never truly recognized, and that his worth was not realized. And well, she died of cancer, and she had rough going there the last year especially.
Hey, your father, though, he died?
He died with a heart attack.
Heart attack, so it was sudden then?
Yes, in the streets of Chicago, something like that. And a week before that, he had been examined, and the doctor said that he was in wonderful shape. His heart was in good shape. But my brother, who was a doctor, said at the time there was only one instrument, and that was in New York, that would have detected his problem. But what the doctors had here in this area didn't record what his problem was. So he died. In a way, it's a good way to go, but it was kind of rough on everybody.
How did he look back on his years now? He was a little bit disappointed with this university idea.
Yes.
Which probably would have worked very well if they had listened to him.
That's right.
But there was one of his setbacks during his time.
And he felt, he said, here I had visions of a starting really a university with many schools of various interests, and he says, I guess I have to be happy in just having a nice good college. No, if all of the money that had been gathered for all these little conference schools, which faded away anyway, it would have made a world of difference. And besides that, he was counting on the Swedes coming in, while we got very, very few Swedes that really supported the Augustana Synod and the Lutheran body. They came over here and they joined the Methodist Church and this church or that church, and they didn't necessarily feel that they were a part of Augustana. My father felt that every Swede should have been part of Augustana. Well, because that's really wishing a little bit much.
Well, today is a complete different story. There are high percentage non-Lutheran.
Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm. So they have to solicit members or students.
That's
or
right.
All kind of
mm-hmm.
walks of life.
That's right.
And the chapel on the hill doesn't serve particularly the Lutherans.
That's right. Well, of course, nowadays there is that ecumenism, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And I think before they felt the Lutheran faith was the only faith and the rest of them were off base. Nowadays they have a broader view of Christianity. And all of that, of course, takes away a certain amount of the affinity toward the Swedish Lutheran element. It kind of disappeared. Yeah, it's disappeared.
Do you think the pastor has as much power as he had 50 years ago or 100 years ago? Or does the regular church go with things for himself?
I think the pastor of the past could be have sort of absolute power. Today, I think he regards his responsibility to the community.
Social services more than...
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Well, to missions and to the local and toward generally following Christian principles. And whether we came from Sweden or whether we came from Timbuktu makes no difference. Of course, in those early days, the Swedes were coming over in droves. And that stopped.
She mentioned something very interesting here, Aina.
Mia.
Mia, yeah. That they had a special napkin in their house. They called it tramp napkin. Every time they came a tramp at the door, they had a special napkin over a regular tablecloth so he didn't soil it on. Did you have any tramps in your house when you came and begged for food?
We had lots of tramps that stop, and we would usually give them sandwiches and let them go their way. I mean, just hand it to them, wrap it up, you know, and hand it to them.
I see.
But we had lots of tramps. I don't know.
Were they Swedish?
I don't know.
She says that they all spoke Swedish and they all had relation in Colorado or Minnesota.
Well, no, I don't think that they were necessarily Swedish. And my mother thought many times that because we were situated there next to the college that they felt that it was an institution.
So they were more brave than a regular household, perhaps.
And they would stop.
And ask for food.
Oh, yes. Once in a while, they would offer to do some work. Well, my mother didn't have exactly any work. She never let any of them enter the house. And we'd especially give them sandwiches or a piece of cake if we had one handy.
That was in your childhood, no?
As I grew up, they usually left a mark on the gatepost. My mother would see to that would be erased. Whatever the mark was, that here I got food, or here the food is no good, or whatever, because they had their own
communication.
My mother saw too that after a tramp visited, she'd go out and look at that gate, and she'd wash off the sign, whether they didn't like the food or.
So some of them were nasty, and even if you gave them something, they.
Some of them didn't like.
Expected more.
Maybe well, or maybe the. I don't remember they ever asked for money, but I know they wanted food. Oh my, we'd get them right and left. But it was quite common. Even my mother-in-law told me that they used to have regular tramps. And sometimes the tramps would come year after year, the same old one. That is,
he had a special trail.
Yeah. And then wanders and maybe go walk further and further south during the winter. But
you know, she mentioned about the special tramp napkin.
Yeah, no, we never treated it with a napkin.
Yeah, your mother really had an interesting life, though, coming there from the Junction City.
Yes, that's right.
And she raised seven children. Did she have any midwife coming into the house then, or because there was no hospitals at that time that she went to?
And my own mother?
Yes.
Well, she had a doctor.
A doctor.
But then she'd have a woman to help her.
Giving birth in her home.
Oh, all of them.
All of them born in the home. So, but the children of our high childbearing mothers, seven children, you had three children.
Mm-hmm.
Were you thinking about this, a lot of children? I mean, they put her down, so to speak. She couldn't do anything more than rear her children. She couldn't go out and work for it.
No,
no. That was out of the question.
It was not considered proper.
So your generation, did you have a special thinking or feeling that you wouldn't have it that way? You mm-hmm. like to do something with your hands,
right.
with your head, whatever it was.
That's right.
So that's why you only had three children.
I felt independent, and I felt that I had a right to my interests, and after my children were old enough, I got a job. Mm-hmm. Went back to teaching school, and I enjoyed it. And I didn't try to do it when the children were little, but people do nowadays, they manage with extra help. But I always believed that a woman should have that right. But as I was brought up, the general feeling was that a woman absolutely had no abilities. They looked at them as inferior to the men. That was just a general thought all over. And
even among educated people?
Mm-hmm. And even my mother, I know she would speak about education. Of course, I was the only girl. But in general, it was her philosophy, I think. She'd say, oh, well, the girls, the men will be heads of families when the girls get married. Yes, I remember her saying that many times.
So they never thought of, for instance, if a girl now married and became a widow, then mm-hmm. it would be nice for her to have something to rely on, her education and mm-hmm. vocation. But she was supposed to marry again then.
Well, I don't know whether that was her philosophy or not.
Divorces were unheard of.
Oh, that was...
They was never used that word.
That was terrible. That was absolutely terrible. And not to be... But I was brought up in that atmosphere, and I know my brothers more than once would talk about the greatest cooks are men, the greatest poets are men, the greatest writers are men, and so on and on and on. And as I grew up, I sort of accepted the inferiority of women, but I resented it. And after a while, I began to feel that they were all wrong in their ideas.
Your father, he was more diplomatic or liberal?
He was diplomatic about that, that's right.
What did he get that feeling, you think? Or
I know, because he was just a sweet person, I think.
Because he was growing up in the same environment, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
Much earlier when it was...
Yeah, that's right. No, I think he might have been influenced by it. And he had only one girl, as far as that's concerned, so...
Were you favored, you think, in the... Of the seven children here?
Was that what?
For your father, did he favor you in any, some respect, you think, your father? Because you were the...
I think he was quite fair all the way around. As far as his children, he was delighted that my oldest brother decided to become a minister. And then he did all he could to support my brothers who became doctors, doctor of medicine, and dentist, and a lawyer. But I know when I decided to go back to school, well, I didn't expect him to help me, but he said, I wish I could help you. I mean, his attitude was, but at the time he wasn't. Well, I said, that's all right, I can manage it. So he was proud of me and all that.
And he wanted you to have all kind of education to be prepared for
mm-hmm.
future days.
But I went back. Of course, I was married. My husband helped me. But insisted on going back to school, and then I got my master's degree in education, and I was on my way to get my PhD in English when I felt that it wasn't the smart thing to do money-wise.
So you didn't look for a Swedish pastor? Dating a Swedish pastor?
No.
There was plenty of them, I suppose.
No, in fact, I think I was pretty much opposed to pastors. To me, there were exceptions, but to me, pastors were a narrow-minded lot. You could count on that. And my experience with L.A. Johnston and his business.
They took care of the whole thing.
And some of them were so contrary against anything in the study of science, and I couldn't understand why they should be that way. But to me, they were a narrow-minded bunch, and we had a lot of ministers that were narrow-minded. And we can talk about it as we read their stories about how they worked and how they were scholars and all that, and I don't see it.
You saw it from a different
viewpoint. I saw it from a different point of view. I would have to have been desperately in love before I would have taken a minister. To me, just a minister was enough to say no, no. And I had admiration for many of the older ministers.
Yes.
But there were, and as I said, my brother, the one that was a doctor, he was telling my father one time, he says, we do have some ministers that are really good, but his pa, we got a lot of punks there too. And that's right, we had a lot of punks.
So that can have a devastating future, like Johnston's demand to cut out drama and theatrical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're stuck.
Yeah, I know, that's right.
How was the outreach now from Augustana faculty and the pastors to the general public in Rock Island and Moline, for instance? Were they a knitted group that clung together? Like today, for instance, you don't see the outreach from Augustana out in the community as it probably should be. Are they more fencing themselves in, you think?
Well, in the days past, I think they stuck to themselves, the Augustana group, and they'd have picnics, and the church, the Swedish church here, and that was the Zion church. I think we stuck into clans, maybe more in the old days. If you weren't of Swedish descent, or you were a foreigner. But today, there certainly isn't that element. And in those days, the faculty wives stayed home. And today, practically every faculty wife has a job someplace. So I mean, I think Augustana in general has the respect of the community, but I don't think we're clannish within ourselves. Of course, we have our faculty meetings, and we have I'm always invited as Professor Emeritus to go to excursions or whatever, and I enjoy that very much. But I don't think that socially we're held within our circle so much. Wherever our interests are happen to be, and that's it.
Now, time has changed too. Like years ago, when pastors and delegates came to your parents' home, they almost expected lodging and food.
Yes.
Nowadays, would it be unthinkable to think
that's
about
right.
To go to the president's home and
that's right.
I'd like to spend my night there.
Yes.
So that's just all the pictures.
We just automatically took them in, or if there were too many, why the different faculty members would take them in.
There was a burden though financially, because he was reimbursed for some of it, but I mean, I'm sure half of it probably your father had to spend on
his own money. His own money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was any visitor that came, and sometimes it was a North Central group. The father would entertain them and have them there at the house and serve them meals.
Do you think that mutual togetherness was good for a feeling? Like today, for instance, they go off the hotel room and they stay with somebody else. At that time, your father, he could talk things over and they could be more personal basis.
Oh yes, there was a touch that was very necessary.
You can set a lot of questions right there. And
that's right. I'm sure that a good many. I met many professors' wives from Chicago University. That is, I was usually given the job of taking, meeting them at the station and then taking care of the wife until my mother got, so she was free. But there was a personal touch there that I'm sure they don't even have today. Everything's official. Then it got to be, it was personal. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But there was disrespect, though, like Dr. Johnston and your father, for instance. He was much younger than Dr. Johnston.
Yeah.
So he had the respect. He couldn't swing his belief because of the age difference, I suppose.
I suppose so, and position. After all, the president of the Synod.
You gotta be show some clout.
Yeah, and he did. Yeah, not helpful either. Just his own personal idiosyncrasies.
But they make you aware of there are certain things people don't see very often. In other words, it goes behind the scene.
I was aware of a lot that went behind the scenes.
You should write the history of Avicenna, because you've seen it.
That's right.
From both behind and in the middle and beyond.
Yes.
You probably are one of the last one, though, that could write a story like that.
I think so.
Because Dr. Bergendorf, he didn't see it. He was a student then in the 20s.
Well, and he sees only the high ups. I know when I make statements, sometimes I feel that I've hurt his feeling, because I look at all these people like quite human beings.
Yes.
That had good qualities and had some very poor ones.
Why do you think people are afraid to see it like it is?
I don't know.
Because of,
I think they just shut their eyes to it. I think Connie just shuts his eyes to that it doesn't exist. They're all heavenly workers for the welfare of God. I don't see it.
And your father, he certainly knew the Aspion side. I mean, the family side of his wives.
Mm-hmm. And well, my father used to take long walks with me when we were living out in the farm, and he poured forth his soul to me that he didn't pour forth to anybody else.
You would think he would be bitter, though. I mean, he was 11 years old coming here to Avicenna College.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course he was a brilliant, had a brilliant head, there's no question about it. But you would think he would be bitter, though, against his stepmother.
He never showed the slightest bit of bitterness that I could detect. In fact, we regarded Grandma Esbjorn, as I was taught to call her. Her name was really Andreen. And whenever there was any family occasion, she was for sure invited. My father, it wasn't in him to show bitterness. Well, my Uncle Philip did. I know one time when he was talking about things. And then my father says, Philip talking to soul. In other words, my father, I think he had the idea or the attitude of the positive side. I think maybe he regarded Mrs. Esbjorn, Mrs. L.P. Esbjorn, Mrs. Esbjorn Andreen, as a woman that was struggling. She was looking for security, and maybe she didn't have anything to live on. I don't know what she had to live on there, and she had five kids.
But just the way throwing out another bunch of kids.
I know, that's a different.
How did she react now to this nice way of doing, meeting her, you know, from your father's side? Did she respect him?
I think so.
She did?
Yes.
But she expected that, more than respect, I suppose.
Possibly. And as I say, I was frequently called upon to spend the nights staying there when Uncle Carl was going to be gone, and he relied on me to be there. As I say, I don't think I was much good, because when I slept, I slept. But I was up there a lot. And I think he thought a lot of me, in a way, too. Although he is full of peculiarities too, but he had some very fine points. He was a marvelous teacher, no question about that.
But he had his rules.
But but he, well, I was up there a great deal. In fact, sometimes they wanted me, because he had a niece, was Aunt Mia's daughter, had some kind of an either accident or sickness or something, and she was bedridden, practically, and she spent the whole summer at Uncle Carl Esbjorn's place, and so they wanted me to sort of be a companion to her, so I was up there practically all summer there with Gunda. And then later on, when Mrs. Constant Esbjorn, there was Aunt Sophie, when her husband died, she lived there for a while, and then she decided to strike out on her own. But she had a daughter, Ocinda.